Welcome to Season 8 of the HPS Cast. I'm your host, Colbert Cannon. If you're new to the pod, HPS is a global investment firm. We manage approximately $100 billion in assets for a broad range of institutional and retail investors. That capital is invested across private and public credit strategies. Each week, I sit down with key relationships to, partners of, and friends of the firm to learn from their experience, ask how that experience shapes their current roles, and give insights into HPS and how we operate. So with that, let's bring in our guest. Our guest this week is none other than the Chief Financial Officer of our very own HPS Investment Partners. This gentleman attended Lehigh undergrad before starting his career in accounting at Price Waterhouse in the late 80s. He left to join a family office in 93 called the Griffin Group, where he spent over a decade as their CFO. In the mid-2000s, he moved into the fund-of-funds business, where as the COO of Ortelius, he expanded his experience set beyond just financial matters. He then met our CEO, Scott Kapnick, and joined the then Highbridge to become its CFO, before playing an instrumental role in managing the buyout of Highbridge Principal Strategies from J.P. Morgan in 2016. He's HPS's CFO, he's extraordinarily effective at what he does, but he's also a great guy and a good friend, and someone I'm legitimately thrilled to be able to work with. So with that, I am very excited to welcome in this week's HPS Cast guest, Paul Nolmeyer, CFO of HPS. Paul, welcome to the pod.
Colbert, good to be here. Thank you for having me.
Paul, people know I like to start from the start. Let's go all the way back. Where are you from originally?
So originally grew up in northern New Jersey, small town called Haworth, just north, 20 miles north of New York City. And it was a great place to grow up.
You end up attending Lehigh, a school in the beautiful Lehigh Valley of Pennsylvania. What was the draw for that for you?
So for me, in selecting colleges, you know, my parents were very influential in terms of where I was going to go. They really wanted me to stay somewhat within a driving distance of our town. And importantly, my father, who was probably the biggest influence in my career, he said, please just go there and get an accounting degree. So it was a great school for that. It was also a great engineering program. I did really well in math, but I thought business was for me. And so I ended up majoring in accounting at Lehigh, and it was just a fantastic experience.
All right. You graduate college in 87. You get a job at Price Waterhouse, PW, before the Coopers got added. And 2 months later, the Black Monday stock market crash happens. Tell our listeners what that experience was like as a young CPA.
It was incredibly frightening. So I had been working for 2 months. I wake up, go to work on Monday morning. Sure enough, the equity markets declined by 25% or so that day. The S&P was down, I think, even more. Global indices, you know, north of 30, and some indices down as much as 50%. And the only thing I could think of was, thank goodness I have a job, and I hope I have a job tomorrow. And so it was really frightening because people were really scared about what was happening in the marketplace, including my parents. They had their net worth, much of it invested in the equity markets. And for me, that started to also frame for me how I thought about risk, market dislocations, opportunities as well. It's certainly a scary period of time in the equity markets, but ultimately it also created great opportunity. And it's actually something that if you think about what we do here at HPS, that is one of the things I think we're quite good at.
For our listeners, if you haven't checked out the Richard Fisher podcast, I'd recommend it as an addendum to that. He tells some great stories about being around during the Black Monday crash. Paul, first jobs are formative, like they really do. You've given us one example of that, you know, living through that early market volatility. What else do you keep with you from that time in your career?
When working at PW, I had phenomenal people to work with, highest integrity, super trustworthy, great mentors when I was there. And I was fortunate enough to be able to have experience where I had exposure to industries, which included entertainment, media, broadcasting, as well as some financial services, but predominantly in entertainment, media, and broadcasting. And as a result of that, I was able to, you know, really have some fascinating engagements there. But it was also an incredibly difficult work environment at PW. There was one period of time where I literally worked 100 straight days. And so for me, that ended up starting to set the framework for me that that was not the right balance, that it was also not necessarily the right path for me to become a partner at the firm or pursue that path. Ultimately, you know, the combination of seeing some of the things that happened in the market, having that incredibly strong foundation with understanding accounting and accounting principles and how it impacts businesses, it led me to want to start to become a bit more entrepreneurial.
So you chose that path of making a move to become a family office CFO, the CFO of the Griffin Group. What was that? What was the institution you joined?
It was really interesting because at the ripe age of about 27 at that point, I was one of the experts internally at Pricewaterhouse focused on broadcasting and media and entertainment. So you have this icon in Merv Griffin, who has his family office called the Griffin Group. And one of my colleagues at Pricewaterhouse said, there's an opportunity to go over there. And at first, you know, be one of the senior finance people. And then ultimately there's an opportunity, they think, to become the CFO of the family office. And so I went, I met with them, hit it off with the then leadership of the family office, and ultimately became CFO and worked very closely with other senior members and Merv to invest the family's net worth.
So family office jobs, in my experience, they can vary very wildly. What did your job actually entail? Like, what were you doing day to day?
It was everything from the basic work that you need to do for family offices, which is the accounting, dealing with other things that certain families of certain wealth have, planes, boats, et cetera. But more importantly, since Merv was very active in terms of his investing, we were active in investing. And so we would look at and evaluate and structure and capitalize and figure out financing associated with any of his investments. And he had a broad range of investments. It ranged from public markets to private markets. In public markets, he had control positions as an example. He had bought from Donald Trump Resorts International, which was fascinating. So I show up in 1993. And by that point, he was already working on the second bankruptcy because it was a very over-leveraged transaction leading into a difficult economic period in time. But it was eye-opening for me. It was my first exposure to distressed investing. It was also the period of time where the Resolution Trust was out there to save all the savings and loans. And we ended up being a very active buyer of hotel assets at pretty big discounts.
The real estate investing part of this is interesting. You know, as you say, it was the RTC era cleaning up the SNL crisis. I've been reading a book about this because it predates my investing career. History doesn't repeat, but it does rhyme. It does feel like a little bit of that vibe right now. Tell me about that. Tell me about the lessons learned from the Resorts Internationals, from these complicated, you know, real estate deals you guys were doing and that you carry with you.
So when you think about the acquisitions we were doing from the Resolution Trust, Merv was in such a great position from a liquidity standpoint that he had capital to go and take advantage of market dislocations. I think that's probably one of the greatest lessons that anyone can learn is making sure you preserve capital because there's always going to be an opportunity to invest in. That holds true today.
What an interesting experience. Paul, you spent over a decade there and then decided it was time to move on. We'll talk about your next step. So why was it time to move on after that 10 years there?
Merv, at that point, this was 2004. He really wanted everyone to relocate to Beverly Hills, which is where he had his corporate headquarters. At my stage, my father was sick and we had just had a young baby girl. And so for us, it was a period of time to be here and be near family. And so I decided this was a perfect time for me to go be even more entrepreneurial, try and do my own thing with a handful of partners. Ended up really working with a firm called Ortelius after a short stint with a smaller fund of funds before that. And Ortelius was backed by a gentleman by the name of Robert Miller, predominantly from our capital, but was really founded by two principals, Prince Pavlos, who happened to be related to Bob Miller, and then Peter DeSourcy, a very smart hedge fund investor. And so we thought that there was a great opportunity. We had very sticky capital with seed investments from Bob Miller and go into the global financial crisis. And so we're sitting there in 2008, and fortunately our capital was sticky, but the returns ultimately in the overall equity markets were down close to 40%. We were down about 20, so we had far better performance in the equity markets, far better performance than many of our peers, but it didn't matter.
Yeah.
Scale just didn't allow us to bring in capital from big institutions.
No, that business model had obviously real problems post 2008-09. Okay, so Paul, up until now, you'd spent your career as a CFO, but now you take on this COO job at Ortelius to help them scale that business. What's different about that role? So like, what else did that encompass for you in terms of your remit?
I'd say probably the biggest thing on that front was, you know, working with the other principals of the firm, going out, trying to market, trying to raise capital. And so different than a lot of other CFOs, a lot of other CFOs just do the financials, put it away, and that's the end of their job for the day. In a COO role, you're much broader. You have involvement with capital raising, maybe other forms of operations, technology, whatever it might be. There, it was really trying to scale the business.
All right, so the fund-to-fund business becomes impossible to scale post the global financial crisis. It's time to figure out the next step. How did you first get introduced to our CEO, Scott Kapnick, and Highbridge?
My brother-in-law is a guy by the name of Greg Lemkaw, former head of the investment bank at Goldman, now currently the CEO of MSD. And he had worked for Scott Kapnick. And one of the things that I was sitting there saying, okay, how do I scale Artelius? It's really hard. What should I think about doing? He goes, look, one of the most successful, best people I've ever dealt with in my career is Scott Kapnick. I used to work for this guy. And so whatever you do, just let's try and set up a meeting and you should go meet him. I went over and met with Scott and interviewed with him for a bit. Certainly seemed to hit it off quite well. And the next thing you know, we're spending time meeting with Scott French, Mike Patterson, Pranima Puri, Faith Rosenfeld, and a bunch of others.
So you join as the CFO and chief risk officer. Tell me about what adding that risk officer element to your role meant for you. What does that encompass?
That really brings into play a lot of things that we think about within the organization, because one of the biggest things for any alternative investment manager, and especially somebody in credit, and especially someone who may have some leverage within their funds, you always have to think about what the downside is. And focusing on the downside is really important. And for us, you know, when I think of risk here, you know, there's a handful of things that I think about, right? First and foremost, you always have to think about cyber. Cyber is a very big risk for any institution that's out there, whether large or small. Second, you know, for us is asset liability matching, right? We have certain funds that have leverage. You want to make sure you have the right kind of structure and mechanics within any of your fund leverage to make sure that you have the ability to weather any sort of downturn in the market or market dislocation on that front. And so making sure you have the right balance of risk in the portfolio is incredibly important.
So Paul, let me cover a couple of things that you've been instrumental in your time here at HPS. So HPS was officially bought out from JP Morgan in March of 2016, but that was the culmination of like 3 years of effort. Tell me a little bit about what that process was like from your seat.
It was an incredible experience and something that I never thought I would be part of in my career. And you're right, it did take about 3 years. Give or take the first 9 months, we spent a lot of time evaluating different scenarios in which we could potentially buy the firm back. We wanted to make sure that JP always had full transparency to anything we were thinking about as part of the transaction. So we shared models. We talked about it openly, and we always wanted to make sure that we ended up on, you know, great terms with JP if and when we ultimately bought the firm back. So 9 months of doing analysis finally gets to the point of, okay, this does make sense, because I think some of the benefits of why HPS being launched under JP originally no longer existed. So you had access to capital. So JP Morgan's balance sheet could put up capital to help seed funds. Once Volcker and Dodd-Frank happened, that can no longer happen anymore. Step two was, okay, you got this gigantic leverage finance business at JP. You have to be able to get some benefit of being in the flow of opportunity set. I think it was almost the opposite because we were an affiliated company owned by JP. Third one was capital raising. Capital raising, phenomenal. JP knows everybody out there. They know every institution. Their private bank is the best at fundraising. Their high net worth and ultra high net worth clients are an incredible source of capital for any of our funds. And so they were incredibly good at raising capital for us. And then lastly, I'd say it was the, you know, institutional quality infrastructure of the firm. And so that also worked. So a couple of them worked, but the inability to have access to capital and be able to borrow from them, and the inability to participate in sourcing or deal flow, those two actually had a great impact on our investors. And so we thought long-term that was not the best thing for our investors. So once we got through and communicated that, then it became a very serious conversation at that point. And we spent a lot of time negotiating and working through and structuring how the transaction would work to make sure all of our investors were protected as part of the transaction. We actually had to go to the Federal Reserve and get them to consent to the transaction.
That's not a five-minute conversation, Paul.
That's not a five-minute conversation at all. Ultimately, we got it to the point where we were able to buy the firm back. And one of the things we always told them was, if we do this, we will end up becoming a bigger partner for you. And so we have, I think, seen that we have been able to live up to that end of the bargain.
Well, so Paul, tell me, you know, the deal closes, you know, then what? Tell me about the challenges of creating a standalone financial institution. You know, for a decade, right, HPS is part of Highbridge and JP Morgan, as you say, with all that institutional heft behind you. You're our CFO. How hard is it to stand up the organization as an independent entity?
I would say setting up our own infrastructure as part of the transition from JP Morgan was one of the more difficult things I've ever done. We had a transition services agreement with Highbridge and JP, so we had great support from them. But effectively, for close to 18 months post, we had to run dual sets of books, dual sets of transactions, reconciling between those two. Our fund accounting and operations team have never been busier. And they did an amazing job. And we had incredible support from JP. But we were probably working fairly close to 18 hours a day for 18 months straight, at least 5 days a week to be able to do it. And the benefit of it, though, Colbert, was that we had a clean sheet of paper. We had this ability to pick and choose what we liked, what we didn't like, and set up our technology the way we wanted it to be so that we built something that we thought was incredibly scalable on a go-forward basis.
Now, it's interesting. As you say, you're not saddled with whatever decades-old, you know, legacy system. It's a great point. Let's talk growth here. You know, headcount at HPS, you started, I think it was probably round numbers. There were like 65 people in what was then, you know, Highbridge Principal Strategies. It's 225 people or so around the time of the spin out. We're a little under 600 now. Tell me about the challenges from your seat of managing that growth successfully.
Look, in the asset management business, the people are your assets. And so as you continue to add those people, you need to make sure that those people fit within the organization, that they integrate well, and that they've had the opportunity to meet a number of people, because ultimately the people here create the culture and the environment that we have, that we work in every day. So in order to maintain the kind of collegial cultural environment that we had at the beginning of the firm and at the time when we spun out from JP Morgan, we've had to work really hard to hire the right people to make sure that they embody some of the key characteristics of people that we want to work at this firm. And integrating those people, it's hard work. And so you don't always get them right. But the key is, if you have them meet a lot of people as part of the interview process, you generally get a pretty good cross-section of feedback within the organization to determine whether or not you think that they're a fit.
You know, it's interesting. We talked a lot about culture in a couple of podcasts, you know, with Adam Miller, HPS's head of talent and professional development. Danny Meyer, actually, restaurateur, had some thoughtful things to say. And I think the common thread, and you touched on this, is you have to invest in it. It doesn't just happen. You know, like it's an intentional thing, you know, to maintain the culture as the firm grows.
For sure. And the only way to do that is to dedicate time to it and really go and meet with these people.
Let's talk about crises. You started your career with Black Monday. You were invested in the equity markets and the global financial crisis. March 2020, COVID hits, the world falls apart. You know, we leave our offices. We're not together in person again for almost 18 months in aggregate. Talk to me about the challenge that created and how you managed the operations of our business during that time.
Yeah, so to touch on the operations first, because there was a whole nother aspect of it, which is the valuation of the portfolios, financing, asset liability matching, where we talked a little bit about risk before. But one of the most important things was we were leaving the office on March 13th. I think we all thought, okay, we're going to go home for 2 to 4 weeks and then we'll be back here. But we needed to make sure that technology worked remotely. And so well in advance of the date that we did the cutoff, where we said everybody should go home and work remotely for whatever period of time, we made sure that we did a lot of testing and we went through literally every employee at the firm. And so credit to our technology team for making sure we were ready to be able to work remotely.
I have to say, as a consumer of that, that seemed like a greatly daunting task, and it was far smoother than I possibly could have imagined. It was incredible.
Thank goodness. And then you pivot and you say, okay, let's get into the portfolio. How's the portfolio doing? And you had a lot of borrowers who came back and they said, you know what? I need flexibility. I'm paying interest or principal. Okay, what does that mean for us? And by the way, this was something that was not created as a result of poor management of those borrowers. And so I think as a firm, we took a very strong approach of wanting to support businesses that also were willing to support their own businesses, meaning would they stand behind it? Would they put additional capital in? Would they support their employees? Things of that nature.
I've said this before. I use the sentence, shared problems required shared solutions, more times than I can remember in 2020. But that's right. That was our philosophy.
That was our philosophy. And it was the right philosophy when I look back on it. And we had to go and then work with many of our financing institutions and say, we need flexibility as well, potentially. Can we work with you? Because we want to make sure we can provide the capital to our borrowers. And we want to make sure that you're going to provide flexibility to us during this period of time. And we were able to come out in a position where we were even stronger post and also capitalize on the opportunities that presented themselves during that period of time. We deployed a tremendous amount of capital. And I think that goes to then build further relationships for the firm that result in repeat business later.
No, it's exactly right, Paul. So let me close with this. You're the chief risk officer of the firm. We're recording this in Q2 of 2023. We've talked about managing through various crises. You know, most recently, we now have rates rising for the first time in seemingly forever. With the knock-on effect, it creates pressure, obviously, on banks, on insurers. How do you think about the risks and opportunities that the current macro environment creates for our firm?
So when you think about the rate environment that we're in today, and you look at some of our portfolio companies that we have, most of the companies that we have, I think, have taken the approach of trying to put on interest rate caps and things of that nature so it doesn't become that big of an impediment. If they didn't have it, they're experiencing a pretty significant rise in their interest costs, and interest coverage, of course, comes down from that to be able to weather any sort of increased rate environment for a longer duration. Doesn't mean we won't have some problems within the portfolio. We had been stress testing rising rates for a long period of time in advance of this, because whenever you fuel that much government support into the economy and keep rates that low for that long, you're bound to get inflation to come back in. And so for us, there's certainly a bit of a breakpoint for portfolio companies, but we had felt very good about being able to have our portfolio companies be able to handle broadly 400 basis points of increased rate increases for the base rate. And our companies have continued to perform quite well within this marketplace.
For those of us here, it's a great comfort to always hear you talk about, you know, how you manage things from your seat. You've been instrumental in our success, will continue to be, and it's a real pleasure hearing your insights. So thank you.
Thank you, Colbert.
With that, Paul, I want to move to the last segment of the podcast, which is something we like to call Best Ideas, where we offer up something that's added value in our lives recently, Best Ideas, because it's our goal as investors to always maximize exposure to those. Paul, you're our guest. I'm going to ask you to go first. What is your best idea this week?
So for me, this was hard. I was kicking around a few ideas. But for me, my best idea is a book that I've recently read called Die with Zero. Bill Perkins is the author. It was a book I picked up as a recommendation from one of my college buddies, one of my best friends. And Colbert, I know what you're thinking right now. Did Paul actually just say die with zero? Did he say go spend all of your money?
Yeah, that's out of character. So keep going.
That's a bit out of character. I'm definitely not saying spend all your money, but I think the book and the title are a bit extreme. They're trying to focus you on the point. And what the author's really saying is maximize your fulfillment in life, minimize your regrets. And in order to do that, spend some of your free time and some of your money on experiences. Because when you really look at life, you know, life is really the sum of all of your experiences. And so he's saying, don't wait until you're too old, where you don't have good health and you missed out on all these opportunities. It's really about balance in your life.
So Die with Zero by Bill Perkins. I will say my wife always says you never regret experiences. Like, we don't need any more things. but it's incredibly important to be able to do these things, to spend this time with your family. I'm a huge believer in that. So that's a fantastic recommendation. Good call. All right. Well, for my best idea this week, Paul, I like to be inspired by the guest of the week. We discussed Paul's time at Lehigh earlier in the pod. And so I started thinking about one of my other favorite Lehigh alums, a gentleman named Michael Smirkanish. Now, Michael is the successful host of a long-running political talk show on Sirius XM's POTUS channel. But in a classic, like, write what you know situation, my specific best idea this week is a fast-paced political thriller he wrote called Talk. Now, before we go further, and I'd say this if my CFO wasn't on the line, the HPS cast, we hold ourselves to a high standard. So I want to disclose a relationship here. My sister, TC, has been Michael's producer and on-air partner for decades, but I promise this is an unbiased recommendation. As I've said many times, the HPS cast cannot be bought. His novel, Talk, it tells the story of an influential talk show host and how he grapples with his impact on a crucial presidential election and managing the conflicts of driving ratings with delivering honest and fair assessments. And while it came out almost 10 years ago now, its themes and topics are as relevant today as they were then. And it's an interesting and topical read, but it's also just fun. Like, it's a fast-moving, exciting thriller in every sense of the word. So, in honor of an esteemed graduate of Lehigh University, let me recommend as my best idea this week the book Talk by a fellow Lehigh grad, Michael Smirkanish. Paul, any views on Smirkanish?
I know of him, but I don't think I've ever met him. But I've also watched some of his shows at times.
There you go.
Being a Lehigh alum, he's got to be a great guy.
All right, Paul, with that, it's time to wrap up for the week. It's always a pleasure to catch up. Thank you so much for coming on the pod. Appreciate your time.
And Colbert, thank you. And thank you for all you're doing on the HPS cast. You're doing a fantastic job. When we first talked about this way back, you know, we were talking about season one, and look at you now.
Thanks again to our guest, Paul Nolmeyer. Check out our show notes to learn more about Paul and his role at HPS. You'll also find a link to Paul's best idea of the week, the novel Die with Zero by Bill Perkins, and to my best idea, the novel Talk by Michael Smirkanish. This podcast was brought to you by Atwill Media with HPS Investment Partners. Please be sure to rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you like to listen. The opinions expressed on this podcast are that of the host, Colbert Cannon, and the guest of each episode, and do not necessarily reflect the views of HPS Investment Partners.